Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have a line open right now for you at 1-800-462-7413. And as always, Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about screening cholesterol for children. In other words, should children be universally screened for elevated cholesterol? There's a controversy surrounding the recommendations that have recently gone out to forthwith.
And?
Dietary intake, memory loss in seniors, cognitive decline. We all worry about that. Is it diet-related in some fashion? We're going to discuss some interesting new provocative research.
And speaking of diet, we have a recipe.
Yes. Tomato and spinach stuffed chicken. I happen to love chicken. This is a wonderful little chicken. You take it out of the oven. You serve it with some white wine. You invite friends over to the house.
Yeah.
You have a good time. You discuss old times. You know, it's everything
just,
you do.
Or you just cook it and eat it.
Oh, you just cook it and eat it. Exactly.
And it's good.
Exactly. And it's just as good if you cook it and eat it.
Again, that number is 800-462-7413. It's toll free, you know. To the phones we go, Zorba. We welcome our first listener now, a caller in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I had a partial knee replacement due to osteoarthritis 14 months ago. And I also have arthritis in my back and, you know, my thumb, a few other, it's osteoarthritis. And I was recently diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis as well. But what's bothering me is my left knee, which is where I had the partial knee replacement. It seems to me like my leg is a little bit taller than my right leg. And I'm not sure, because I have scoliosis, and I just wondered if that's possible.
And you're thinking that maybe the leg length difference is responsible for the back pain?
Or if there is a leg difference, am I just imagining that?
Well, you've got a number of things, you know, going on, like you said. You probably have a degenerative joint disease, you know, old, you know, the osteoarthritis that's associated with the older that we get. You've got psoriatic arthritis that in itself can produce problems. You've got scoliosis, which is a curvature of the spine. So first of all, let's go to leg length, first of all. Very difficult to measure. Very, very difficult. You know, put your leg out and try to measure to your ankle. That's what we often do. We measure from the pelvis to the inside of the ankle, the inner ankle, not the outside, but the inside. And as you know, if you straighten your leg out a little bit more, you'll get a half an inch out or a quarter of an inch. So it's incredibly difficult to actually be able to measure leg length because it's related to muscular control. In other words, it's one of those things that you can't measure. Now, there are lots of arguments. The chiropractors say, yes, this means a lot. Physical therapists say maybe. Certainly if it's an inch, it does mean a lot. Certainly after if you've had hip surgery or leg surgery and you're off by a half an inch, that does mean a lot. But if you've been born with it, I think it probably
means. Well, this partial knee surgery could have been responsible.
Absolutely. And so that might be that which is responsible. Now, I take it this is because you have pain. Is that why you're calling up? I mean, you're not curious.
I've had pain in my back.
Right, right. Are you going to physical therapy or doing back exercises?
Well, actually, I went to my doctor a couple weeks ago, and he told me that it didn't have anything to do with the knee replacement. And that it was probably the scoliosis, which is causing more the arthritis, which is causing the scoliosis, which, you know.
I would respectfully disagree. I would say everything adds to your pain. The arthritis, the scoliosis, the psoriatic arthritis, and the knee replacement might add to it only because of the way you may be walking. In other words, kind of all adds up together. It's really hard as clinicians to separate these things out. Going to physical therapy, doing any exercises at all?
Well, he told me to stop right now because, I mean, I can put my hands on the floor without bending my knees.
Oh,
I'm extremely flexible.
Oh, wow.
But right now, he said to not exercise. And my back actually is getting a little bit better.
Well, good. I think following, sometimes it's good to lay off of exercise because exercise cannot be good. And I think before you go back to exercise, it might be useful to send you once or twice to physical therapy just to see what the right exercises are for you, for your back, for your psoriatic arthritis and your regular arthritis, and let us know what happens. Okay.
Well, thank you. Yes.
You're welcome.
All right, I appreciate that.
Thank you for your call.
We appreciate the call. Can you touch your toes without bending your knees?
You know, I can't touch my toes when I bend my knees.
I can touch my knees without bending my elbows.
No, I am not supple. I've always wanted to be able to do things like that that people can do. That's always shocking. Even when I was in high school, I could barely touch my toes with my hands. How about you? Were you able to touch your toes with your hands?
Not for a long time.
My fingertips, yeah.
800-462-7413. Want to talk with Zorba? 1-800-462-7413. To Andalusia, Alabama we go now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having such a great program.
Aren't you nice?
Well,
thanks for the
you.
Call. How can we help?
I have a persistent problem with a runny nose that my primary care physician has prescribed two separate nasal sprays, neither of which are effective. And the problem is it doesn't run all the time, but when it does, it can be embarrassing because all of a sudden I find that my nose is dripping.
Taking any Sudafed at all?
No, I take Zyrtec.
Zyrtec. Does that do anything?
I'm not sure why I take it, except I have some sort of condition that if I don't take it 2 or 3 days afterwards, I start itching like crazy.
Okay, so the Zyrtec you're taking for allergies. I've got a couple suggestions for you.
Okay.
Number one, sometimes over-the-counter Sudafed will do it. 30 milligrams once or twice a day will do it, or the long-acting tablets that are a little bit stronger but last for 12 hours. So you might want to try that first of all. Go look, see if over-the-counter Sudafed works, if you can tolerate it. If you've got high blood pressure, you can't take Sudafed unless you get your pressure checked.
I don't have that problem.
Okay, so Sudafed over-the-counter may work. That's one thing I would try. Easy, inexpensive, generic works as good as the name brand.
Okay.
If that fails, there is a spray called Atrovent. That's the name brand, A as in apple, T-R-O-V as in Victor, E-N-T, Atrovent. Now, Atrovent is a very interesting spray. We use it for people with chronic bronchitis to cut down on the mucus that they produce. They produce lots of mucus, and they take a couple of sprays of Atrovent 3 or 4 times a day in their lungs, and they produce less mucus. So a number of years ago, they put out an Atrovent nasal spray in two sizes, a regular size and a size that's a little bit more concentrated. And for many people who have a drippy nose, the Atrovent spray, which is prescription, only works. So I would first try over-the-counter Sudafed, and if not, call your doctor and say, hey, this stuff isn't working. I want to try Atrovent. And you can also look it up on the web, A-T-R-O-V, as in Victor, E-N-T.
Okay.
Nasal spray, not the inhaler spray for chronic lung disease, and see if it works. We don't usually know the cause for these things. They're not allergies.
Let me throw a caution in, Zorba, on those over-the-counter nose sprays. I've mentioned this before. But I don't think I've ever been sicker in my life than withdrawing after taking those nasal sprays over the counter for too long. It recommends, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks. I took it for a couple of months, and it was really hard to get off.
That's right. The over-the-counter sprays, and you've got prescription sprays. What he's taking is not over-the-counter.
Yeah.
But the over-the-counter sprays, such as Afrin, are not good for more than 3 days. And Tom became a nose spray addict. And that's really what it is, because what happens is your nose becomes really, really awful when you try to go through withdrawal. And it does. It takes up to a week to get better. And like you say, it's terribly uncomfortable. Yeah. So beware of over-the-counter stuff.
And good luck to you.
Let us know what happens.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some new recommendations or some interesting news about screening children for cholesterol?
Well, it's interesting because there was an expert panel that looked at this, published an article in the journal Pediatrics, which is one of the more renowned journals, and they said we really ought to start to screen 9 to 11-year-olds for cholesterol. From one point of view, you would say, well, this might make sense because maybe we should be treating children, you know, for cholesterol. We know from many, many years ago when they did autopsies in the Korean War, they were shocked to find out that 18-year-old young men and boys had cholesterol deposits in their coronary arteries by the time they were 18. And so, you know, lo and behold, by the time you're 18 or 20, for some people, they already have cholesterol deposits. So they said, well, let's screen, and then we can begin to change the diet of some of our children. Well, the other side of this, which I think is equally valid, is that if we start screening children for cholesterol, we may start to put children on cholesterol-lowering drugs when there is no proof that cholesterol-lowering drugs will actually make a difference in their lifespan. In other words, we know for adults they're useful, but we don't know for children.
Well, but I'm on a cholesterol-reducing drug.
But you're not a child.
No, but I mean, if it helps me, why wouldn't it help a child?
Well, that's very interesting. There's recently a very, very good study on women with cholesterol-lowering drugs, and they found that women who are placed on it for what's called primary prevention, no evidence of heart disease, have a significantly increased risk of developing diabetes 10 years later if they're on cholesterol-lowering drugs. In other words, there are side effects to cholesterol-lowering drugs. One of the side effects may be that it increases your risk for diabetes. Well, this is new research.
Why doesn't my doctor tell me about that?
Well, because it's new research and you're not a postmenopausal woman.
Last time you looked,
you were not a postmenopausal woman. Okay. But in other words, so taking these children and putting them on a lifetime of cholesterol-lowering drugs may not be good for them. Like you might say, well, it's probably good. Yeah. Use it. But the answer is it may not be good.
Well, so what's the bottom line or the recommendation?
Well, I think the bottom line is obesity. I think the issue is still obesity and diet. I think you don't have to be, quote, a rocket scientist, wherever that term came from. I mean, we know it came from the 60s. Yeah. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that we're doing a poor job of feeding our children, that children do not eat enough fruits and vegetables, they don't eat enough perishables, they eat too many carbohydrates, they're overweight, they're risk for diabetes. You don't have to check their cholesterol to know that you've got to improve their diet. Now, if they have a specific reason to check their cholesterol, like a family history or a dad will say who died at a young age of cardiovascular disease, that's a different issue. But this particular recommendation was let's look at all children and test them for cholesterol. And I'm on the side of I don't think this is a good idea.
Interesting. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. To Detroit, Michigan we go now, Zorba. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
My name's Greg, and I'm calling pretty much about my wife. Right now, they're saying that she has fibrosis. I'm trying to think of the name. Sorry, guys, I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
Has to do with her lungs.
Uh-huh. So she has pulmonary fibrosis?
That's what I'm looking for, yeah.
Okay.
And she's at the, you know, going to the doctor, and they've done one lung biopsy. That didn't work, so they're sending her to another, like a specialist.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So what I'm trying to get at is what was possibly the cause? I mean, this has come on slowly, but now she's got very short breath. You know, she can't walk a long distance. She's only 41.
Well, pulmonary fibrosis is a serious disease. And if you look it up on the web, have you done that yet?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So, you know, you've seen it can be caused by some things. It also is what we call idiopathic. It can, you know, just appear out of nowhere. And when your lungs are elastic. When we take a deep breath, they kind of spring back. You know, we take a deep breath and they spring back. And when you have pulmonary fibrosis, they don't spring as well. You know, because they become what's called fibrotic, and they, you know, so her lung capacity goes down, her ability to get oxygen into her bloodstream goes down, and then she becomes short of breath with walking. And the reason that they're most likely doing the biopsies is they want to see is there a reason for the pulmonary fibrosis that they can begin to attack? Is there a medication that they can put her on that will actually help her? That's the reason behind doing that. What have the doctors told you so far?
Basically, not much.
Not much. And when did they make the diagnosis?
Well, it was a quick diagnosis by when her primary care, then she was sent to emergency room where they did a biopsy a little bit ago. And about a week or so ago, and now they sent her to the specialist in Dallas, Texas to they're going to do it again in a few more days.
Okay. And that's really – that's exactly the right course to take. What you want to do is you want to find out, is there a cause? Is it what we call idiopathic, which means no cause? What is her prognosis? Pulmonary fibrosis is a serious disease. What can I do to make her as good as she can possibly be? And that's where you really want to go to a center. Like you said, she's in Dallas now, in a center where they have physicians who work with lots of people with pulmonary fibrosis. That's critical.
Right.
That's critical. Okay. This is not something for primary care. This is somebody for a pulmonary fibrosis specialist. And they're pulmonologists, lung specialists. Many of them deal with it all the time, some more than others. If it were my wife, I'd say, I want to know how often you deal with this, and I want the best person in my area who deals with a lot of it, because there's a lot of what we call hand-holding with this. In other words, she gets an infection. What do we do about it? What's step one, step two, step three? We do quickly at home so she doesn't end up in the hospital.
That was exactly my next question. What can we do?
Right,
This is what it is. You know, what's the treatment? And, you know, what can we expect?
Exactly.
Is it preventable?
Right.
You know, so that the children don't get it, you know. And
right.
Again, what questions do we ask the doctor?
Right. Well, the questions you want to ask are, what can I do to kill? First of all, what's her diagnosis? Pulmonary fibrosis, if that's it. What's it caused by? Do you know or do you not know? What's her prognosis? What can we look for in the future? How do we step in quickly to keep her from getting sick? In other words, what's the first symptom that we should look for? And then how often, what exactly do we do to keep her well? Just like fitness for health. There's fitness for your lungs that you can do. And then of course, how does this affect the children? So,
okay.
So good luck. I think you are taking the right steps.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me on the show.
Sure. We appreciate the call. Thank you very much. And before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Jim, who is not only a listener, but is the president of the New Hope Family Shelter in Bloomington, Indiana. Jim asks, Dear Zorba, we keep only a few minor first aid items on hand, and as a matter of policy, ask residents to go to the local volunteers in a medicine clinic or to the emergency room to obtain more serious medications they need. We do not have any staff members with medical training. With that in mind, should we keep an EpiPen on hand?
Well, first of all, EpiPens, in order to keep an EpiPen on hand, you have to know how to use an EpiPen. It's not hard to learn how to use it. These are adrenaline pens we hand out at the pharmacy, and the person, you know, gives it to them themselves. The real issue is who's the appropriate person to get the EpiPen. So in other words, when I'm a physician, I give it to someone and I say, if you're having trouble, you use the EpiPen. And for instance, with the EMTs, we have training. We train EMTs how to give an EpiPen and when to use it specifically for that. So I think an EpiPen, if you're going to have it in the first aid kit, has got to be used by someone who knows how to use an EpiPen and when it's appropriate to give it to that person. That's the issue. It's not the pen itself. It's easy to do. It's the decision whether or not to give it to that person. And when it's not prescribed for the person and somebody else makes the decision, I think they have to have some training.
So let me rephrase his question. If somebody at the New Hope Family Shelter in Bloomington, Indiana is qualified to use the EpiPen, or some people there are qualified,
or trained,
and somebody would not use it if he or she was not qualified, is it a good idea to
Absolutely,
have that on hand?
Absolutely, 100%. I think it's a great idea to have on hand, and all you need to do is go through some training to find out what's appropriate and what's not. And frankly, you call 911, you're having trouble, they'll get on the phone and they'll say yes. They may put you in charge if somebody knows what they're doing and say give the EpiPen. So the answer is yes, it should be part and could be part of a good first aid kit.
Well, we always try to be on hand. And here at Zorba Pastor on Your Health. So if you have a lifestyle question for the show, just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A yummy recipe coming up. Lots more of your phone calls, too. Some more research to talk over. And, of course, our medical myth buster later on in the hour. You're going to want to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But right now, Zorba recipe time. This really looks yummy to me. Tomato and spinach stuffed chicken.
Yes, I love chicken. Chicken is my favorite. Mm-hmm. I'm an omnivore. It's my favorite dish. I love chicken. I like turkey, but chicken. And any way that I can make a chicken dish that tastes different is always good. I mean, it's a great meat dish to be able to add variety to. Mm-hmm. And when I make chicken at home, my wife, Penny, is happy. When I make steak at home, she's unhappy.
Yeah.
You know why she's unhappy when I make steak at home?
Because she doesn't want to eat any steak.
No, she loves steak, but I never do it right. Because steak is very, very particular. You know, you want it medium or you want it rare or you want it medium rare. You want the outside to be hot. You want the inside to be cool. It's a very fussy meat.
It is.
When you look at steak. When you look at chicken, you can serve it hot. You can serve it warm. You can serve cold.
That's true.
It's very, very different. So we humans often do better with chicken. Okay, so and then making a chicken dish that is tasty and useful and good because we should be eating more chicken than beef is always good. So let's start out with 1 cup of shredded spinach.
1 cup of shredded spinach.
Right.
Now, can I say something about spinach?
Oh, please.
I love frozen spinach. Uh-huh. I love the chopped frozen spinach. Uh-huh. I don't so much like fresh spinach, and I hate canned spinach.
I have not eaten canned spinach since I was a kid. My mother used to serve it with canned peas.
Yeah.
Yuck.
Yeah.
But I like frozen spinach and fresh. You could use either one in here. There is a different texture because, of course, if I got the chopped frozen spinach, I can just use it instead of the shredded thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, God. I have a question. Could we get you into the kitchen to make this recipe? Woohoo! That'd be great.
Not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
This is theoretical.
Theoretical. Okay. I'm just wondering if I should be able to do it. Okay. 1/2 cup of diced onions.
1/2 cup of diced onions.
3/4 cup of Parmesan cheese.
3/4 cup of Parmesan cheese.
Now, when you buy Parmesan cheese, do you buy the Kraft Parmesan cheese?
I better not, or you'd yell at me.
Right. It's okay, but really, fresh Parmesan cheese is so much better. Romano cheese, which is cheaper, I have no idea why, but I know all the cheese people will now tell me why. And in fact, if you know why Romano is inevitably cheaper than Parmesan, let me know. And I don't mean the Parmesan that comes from Parmesan, Italy. I know that's more expensive, but it's always more expensive if Parmesan. But 3/4 cup of Parmesan or Romano would be great.
Okay.
And of course, make sure it's made in Wisconsin or it's not acceptable. 1/2 cup of sun-dried tomatoes drained of oil and chopped.
1/2 cup of sun-dried tomatoes drained of oil and chopped.
Now, do you think the sun-dried tomatoes are actually dried in the sun?
Probably not.
I bet they're not. Yes, I bet it's just like a type. I bet they're done in an oven. But they wouldn't say oven-dried tomatoes because they wouldn't sell.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, sun-dried, you've got an image, don't you? It's kind of Italy. Yeah. It's outside.
And the federal government doesn't regulate what you can say about tomatoes.
No, I bet it doesn't. Okay. A tablespoonful of dried basil. If you've got fresh, it's going to be even better. Okay?
Big tea, fresh, or dried basil.
That's right. Fresh is even better. And by the way, I get my basil at my local Asian grocery store, and it's about 1/4 of the price. It's wonderful. And often Asian grocery stores and Hispanic grocery stores have basil, thyme, fresh herbs for not very much at all.
Okay.
Okay, 4 or 5 ounce skinless, boneless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm. 4 or 5, what?
Well, 4 of these. We have 5 ounces on the recipe, but they sometimes come in 4, sometimes they come in 5, they come in 6.
Skinless, boneless chicken breast halves.
That's right, halves. And I have 5 ounces because that's in between 4 and 6. They come in 4s, 5s, and 6s. 2 cloves of garlic minced.
2 cloves of garlic minced.
And of course, the ubiquitous salt and pepper.
S&P.
Let's make it. Preheat the oven to 375 degrees. By the way, you have a thermometer in your oven, Tom?
No.
You should. You should. Monica cooks. She bakes periodically, doesn't she? Or puts things into. Well, how about Cooper?
Let's say yes to that.
Let's say yes to that. Maybe Cooper does. But if you're going to put anything in the oven ever, you want an oven thermometer to see how far off your oven is. Now, my oven is off 15 degrees. So 15, that's what it is. So, I mean, you've got to have a regular thermometer in there. Mm-hmm. 375 degrees. Combine the spinach, onions, cheese, tomatoes, and basil in a mixing bowl. Set it aside. And then slice a small 2-inch pocket into the side of each chicken breast. You can do this with a boning knife. A boning knife is sort of a long knife, which is sharp, so you can get it in underneath there. Yeah. Paring knife is sort of the opposite of a boning knife. Mm-hmm. Stuff each breast with an even amount of spinach mixture underneath that meat, and then seal the edges, kind of put them down there. Mm-hmm. Then top each breast with some minced garlic, and then season with salt and pepper.
That sounds really good.
Bake it for 25 degrees and serve it. It is good. It is good. I would serve it maybe with a nice white wine. Parfumé, being a local Wisconsin wine that I happen to love, I think is really good. Mm-hmm. I'd probably serve it with some fresh bread, maybe some crusty bread on the side, and maybe a bit of a fresh salad, maybe a nice fresh salad on the side there.
Some mashed potatoes in there, too.
I wouldn't mind some mashed potatoes. I like mashed potatoes. Some mashed potatoes would be good with this, and maybe a little cheesecake for dessert. We've got a whole meal there.
There you go.
That's it. Tomato and spinach stuffed chicken for your next celebration meals.
And if a listener would like this recipe?
I bet that you can go to our website, zorbapastor.org, and on that website, you will find this recipe, many of our archived recipes. You'll find pictures of Tom and me. You can sign up for our weekly podcast, and that's at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. To Sharon, Wisconsin, we go now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I had a question about food and food safety. I cook pretty often with a friend of mine, and we disagree on how to begin with our meats. She is from another country originally, from Ecuador, and I don't know if that plays into it, but she insists that you've got to wash, not just wash, but scrub your meat. So when you take it out of the freezer or thaw it, then you need to get right to scrubbing the outside. And I guess it kind of surprised me. I hadn't heard of that. My mother didn't teach me to do that, and I know with maybe chicken and turkey and things with skin, I guess I wash it off and take care of it, but when I have a chunk of beef or a rump roast, I had never thought of washing it, so I wanted to ask Dr. Thorpe about that.
Scrub it with a scrub brush or something?
Yeah, kind of like a vegetable brush.
Now, I have a question. Have you been to Ecuador?
I have not, no.
Okay. Can you imagine what the butcher... Is that your child?
Yes.
Is that a future public radio listener talking right now?
An addict like I am.
Absolutely.
At least he will be.
It's great. We want to try to track our audience younger, so make sure that he fills out the Nielsen survey when it comes to the house. Ecuador. Yep. Butcher shops. It's exactly as you can imagine. What happens is they're not clean. I'm sure there's some butcher shops that are clean. I don't want to disparage the whole country. But on the whole, when you get meat in Ecuador, I'm sure the first thing you should do is wash it. And the reason is there's often E. coli all around. When you cut meat, you often have E. coli contamination around the outside of meat. And that's why she was taught to wash her meat. In America, we don't have the same amount of E. coli problems at all with meat. And so we don't have to wash our meat. Meat, you can just put it in the oven. You do not have to wash it before it is, because on the whole, it's safe. If you go to a reasonable butcher and they use reasonable precautions, there's not going to be much E. coli, any E. coli or very much E. coli on the outside of meat. And frankly, if your meat is cooked appropriately to about 180 degrees, you're going to kill the E. coli that are on the outside.
Oh, okay.
So from her point of view, coming from Ecuador, that's exactly what you would do. But from our point of view in the U.S., you certainly don't have to do it. And if you try to keep her from washing her meat, it's probably not going to happen. You know what I mean?
No, I don't tell her what to do. That's for sure.
Right. It ain't going to happen. She's going to continue to wash it. But you don't have to. And when you look at E. coli contamination and food poisoning in this country, it's a big issue. It tends to be with ground meat that is pink in the middle, because when it's pink in the middle, it hasn't gone to the temperature where E. coli can be killed. Now, I have been to Ecuador. I've been all over South America. I've been to India. And if I were in any of those places, I would wash it. Now the chicken issue is kind of interesting. Chicken has salmonella, and the salmonella can be on the outside of the chicken and on the inside. And that's why after you cut chicken on a cutting board or anyone else, you've got to make sure you clean that cutting board. And chicken must be cooked to 180 degrees. It's either 180 or 185. I always have to look it up to make sure that you kill the salmonella. Because chicken is in much of the chicken we eat has salmonella contamination. As long as he listens to public radio when he's eating his meat, he'll be hunky-dory.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before we take a short break, Zorba, let's play another round of Stump the Doc. Our contestant today is Charlie in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, who has a question about chlorine. Charlie writes, years ago, while working at a salmon hatchery in Alaska, another worker and I lost our sense of smell due to cleaning rearing pen nets that required a very strong chlorine solution to kill and release the clinging algae. After 3 weeks, our sense of smell returned. More recently, I noticed that my eyes seemed to tear up in the swimming pool areas while attending my daughter's swim meets. Is this a long-term impact of previous exposure or merely a normal reaction to the noise and splash of high school competitions?
Oh, a lot of people's eyes tear up when it's chlorine. I don't think it's related to chlorine from years ago. I mean, haven't you been in a swimming pool with chlorine and then your eyes start
even if you're
not in the pool, it's a gas that comes out of the water, and that's why you smell it. That's why you smell it on the kids or the adults when they get out, and then that gas is all around us, and some people are more sensitive than others. But no, I don't think this is related to what you had 3 years, a number of years ago. I think it probably is related to just the love that you have for your child, and you want to see them swim.
Oh, well, don't swim from your lifestyle mysteries. Send them to the show and try to stump Public Radio's favorite family doc. Just send your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a really interesting topic to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls, too. And, of course, our medical myth buster right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, a question. Does dietary intake have any effect on memory loss? That's been in the news.
Right. And this was because of a research paper came out of the Mayo Clinic and was reported at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Neurology. Mm-hmm. And they looked at a number of people looking at caloric intake. And what they found was that people who consumed more than between 2,000 and 6,000 calories a day. Now, 6,000 calories a day is a ton of calories. Yeah. I mean, most of us need about 1,800. So we're talking
have to be a football player to eat
that much, or morbidly obese. And what they found was, once you got over a certain number of calories, the more you consumed, basically the higher the risk of developing a cognitive impairment, what's called MCI or mild cognitive impairment.
That's early onset Alzheimer's.
Well, cognitive impairment is a broader umbrella than Alzheimer's. All memory loss is not Alzheimer's.
Right.
The only way to prove Alzheimer's is to take a brain biopsy, look at it in a microscope, and see if you have Alzheimer's, or do an autopsy when the person dies. And what we find is that half the people who have cognitive impairment when they get older is significant. When you do the research, only half of them actually have Alzheimer's, and the other have mild cognitive or severe cognitive impairment, either due to strokes, hardening of the artery, heart disease, alcoholism, vitamin deficiencies, a whole bunch of other things.
Got it. Okay, so we're not talking Alzheimer's disease with this research, but None of us want, you know, cognitive impairment either.
No, that's exactly it.
So over 2,100 calories a day may put us at risk.
Well, what we're seeing now is that obesity, one of the other risks for obesity might be cognitive impairment. That's what we're looking at. We know when you're overweight, you're more likely to get diabetes and high blood pressure and heart disease. But it might be now it's diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, and brain dysfunction. And so when you look at it from that point of view, it might be another reason to begin to take off the weight and begin to exercise.
But, not to put too fine a point on it, but can I eat 2,100 calories a day and not become obese?
Well, I don't think the study was really – they didn't take people, follow them for 10 years and measure how many calories they
had. But I mean just on a general basis.
No, I think it's just saying that if you're eating too many calories, one of those things may happen is that you may start to have cognitive impairment. We know that exercise also helps memory, and we know that when people get – heavier and heavier, they exercise less. So what we may also be looking at the exercise effect. I think the bottom line of this study is that eating an appropriate diet is good not only metabolically for your body, but is good for your brain and may help starve away, if you will, cognitive impairment, something that none of us want and is a big issue as we get older.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Fine. How can we help?
I'm calling today with a question about multivitamins. I've been debating on, you know, what would be a good multivitamin to buy. So many different claims out there, so many different companies, you know, all trying to make a buck. You know, there's the synthetically cheap ones that you can buy at, like, just the local grocery store, and there's ones that you can buy on the Internet and some other companies and, like, in the nutrition food store that are more expensive, that are from Whole Foods. I really don't know which one to go with. I'm trying to figure that out.
Zorba can help you with that. Are you taking multivitamins now?
I am.
What are you taking?
Right now, I take a brand. It's actually from Target. It's called Up and Up.
And that is the multivitamin that you're taking.
It is.
Good, good, good. Well, let me tell you, let me separate out vitamins from supplements because they actually are separated out. So vitamins are regulated by the FDA. Supplements are not. So supplements like glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, or we'll say zinc, or a vitamin such as, we'll say, ginkgo biloba, are not regulated by the FDA. And therefore, you can't be assured of what's on the label is actually going to be in the pill. But vitamins are the proverbial horse of a different color. And basically, if it says it has a certain amount of vitamin in there, it's in there. And not only that, but if it has USP, which stands for U.S. Pharmacopoeia, at the end of the generic label, it means that it meets certain dilution requirements. In other words, is it dissolving actually in your stomach? Mm-hmm. And I mention that because there was a guy who did colloidal vitamins, and he made a gazillion dollars the fact that he said, well, wait a minute, you know, you'll never see my vitamins in your stool because basically they're liquid. That's why you won't see them. And when you see it, sometimes you'll see a hard milled pill in your stool from vitamins, and he said those vitamins really didn't leach out of that skeleton, but they really did. But getting back for just a second, there are a couple of ways to evaluate it. First of all, I like house brands. In other words, Target, CVS, Walgreens, Costco, Walmart. The house brands stand behind their vitamins. So I know that they don't want to have their name tarnished, and therefore they're going to make sure the vitamins are really in there. So
and they're cheaper.
They're actually cheaper. No, they're cheaper. That's right. Tom knows me. I think if you're going to spend your money on nutritional things, you spend it on perishables, fruits and vegetables, because they really do mean something. So getting the Target brand, awesome. But there are two places that you can also get additional information that I like. The first is ConsumerReports.org, O-R-G, and they will be in your local library. Most libraries, actually, you go online in the library and you can look it up. You can look at their vitamin analyses if you want to. They're very good. They have a natural foods part of ConsumerReports.org. But there's another one called Consumer Lab, one word, ConsumerLab.org and ConsumerLab.com, and they are great, and they evaluate vitamins also. So if you want a little extra bang for your buck, go to one of those two sites and evaluate it. But I think Target multivitamin, way to go. Save your money. Whole Foods, which a lot of people, including me, call Whole Paycheck, I think tends to be a waste of money when it comes to vitamins.
Good advice. Appreciate it, guys.
Yeah. Yep. Take care. Thank you. Thanks very much.
We appreciate the call. Now, Zorba, on those multivitamin bottles, they have percentages of C, A, B. Oh,
right.
Does it make any sense to try and compare that list with a list on another?
I don't really think so. And in fact, that's how they actually label it. So in other words, if you go, we'll say, to Target and it says comparable to Centrum,
yeah,
it may not be exactly the same as Centrum. So in other words, vitamin C might be 120% of the minimum daily requirement in Centrum. And they do that in order to sort of copyright what's in their multivitamins. So they'll make slight changes that don't mean very much in the vitamin to try to sort of copyright what it's actually about.
Let me get to the basic here. I've been taking a multivitamin for years and years and years. And just lately I've said to myself, maybe I'll just quit taking this. I'm not even sure. And I remember years ago you used to
say
multivitamins are useless.
That's right.
So
that's
where
right.
are we
that's
now
right.
on that?
That's right. And in fact, a number of people have said Americans have the most expensive urine in the world because we pee out all the vitamins that we don't need. I'm always on the side of don't do any harm. So if we take a multivitamin, my initial response has always been, hey, you can buy a house brand for $10 for 1 year or $15 for 1 year. That's cheap. I mean, and so you're assured of getting the minimum daily requirements. The only issue is, can you make it into a habit? And can you swallow the pills? Well, if you can't, then you get a gummy bear equivalent vitamin.
But you're not absolutely sure that these vitamins are doing me any good.
I am not at all. And in fact, the more and more we look at things, I begin to wonder about them, such as the beta carotene issue and that beta carotene supplementation in smokers increased lung cancer. Vitamin E at 400 international units a day given to men, 17% increase in the risk of prostate cancer.
Yeah.
And so I'm beginning to question really the benefit of multivitamins, but I'll tell you something. As long as I continue to take them, I must still believe in them. So I would still, I think on the whole, the benefit still outweighs the risk.
So you're telling me because you take them, I should take them
exactly
too.
Exactly right, Tom. If I take them, you have to take them.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster now. We have a listener myth today from a listener named Lori that deals with lemon juice. Lori writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba. A few weeks ago, I read somewhere, and I don't know where, that lemon juice helps with metabolism. I can't find anything about it and was wondering if you've heard anything or can find something about it."
Well, you know, this is one of those old wives' tales, you know, the fact that one thing will actually be the secret to actually getting our body to metabolize differently. And a number, if you look on the net, look all over, they'll say adding a little bit of lemon juice will kind of stoke up the body and will get your body to actually burn more calories. Now, if that were the case, now let's just make an assumption. If that were the case, that would mean that if we drank lemonade, non-caloric lemonade with every meal, we'd all be thin, right? All you have to do is drink non-caloric lemonade to be fine. Or you could just drink lemon juice straight up at the end of a meal. It would stoke your metabolism. You would be thin.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's no one thing that makes us thin. Now, when we look at metabolism, it's very, very difficult to figure out what makes metabolism sort of rev up so that we burn our calories and what doesn't. We know when you exercise, it revs up metabolism. There's no doubt about it. But I don't think there's any good, credible scientific evidence that taking a teaspoon of lemon juice at the end of a meal or something is going to make you burn those calories and become thin as a rail.
Yeah, so this is junk science.
I think it's junk.
What really surprises me about this is that she says in her email that she can't find any information on this. There's information. You go to the internet, you can find
information on anything. Maybe what she meant was she couldn't find any good information on it. And so she came to the source, our show.
By the way, she adds a P.S. Love your show. And Tom, eat your veggies. They'll put hair on your chest. Have a myth you'd like Zorba to put the squeeze on? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. And a listener now, Zorba in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I have a struggle that I've been facing all my life with weight gain and obesity. And really about 3 years ago, I came to the realization that I'm addicted to sugar. And when I eat it, I just crave more and more. So since that time, I have really stop this compulsive behavior by stopping sugar consumption almost entirely. I still eat minute amounts of sugar, but I read every single label of everything that I consume. And so my question is, how can a product that be labeled sugar-free when maybe its second ingredient, this is an actual case, first ingredient was water, the second ingredient is corn syrup, but it's labeled sugar-free?
Ain't that the truth? Ain't that the truth? How could they possibly do that? What lobbyist in Washington possibly said you could say sugar-free when you're using high fructose corn syrup? How did they get away with that? Right, right. You know what I? You know my answer to them is shame on you. Shame on you. Here it is. You take a consumer. You're clearly duping them. I mean, come on. It's absolutely duping them. You know, you're putting in sugar-free, so you know you're not going to get sugar and products that are just as concentrated caloric-wise as sugar. And the answer is, yes, you don't get sugar. You get high fructose corn syrup, which pretty much is just like sugar. It's just cheaper. I mean, there are differences, but frankly, high fructose corn syrup in an equivalent caloric amount is going to add just as many calories as sugar. And so they can write sugar-free and put it in there, and they're doing it to sell their product, and they're doing it because they want to, you know, as a consumer, they want to lie to you. I mean, I think this is an abomination. I think it's awful. And then the real issue is, why can't the FDA come in and say it has an equivalent amount of high fructose corn syrup? And the answer is, there is a tremendous amount of lobbying money on the side for this. Tremendous amount. So we consumers lose, and the companies that produce high fructose corn syrup, you know, then essentially win. And I think this is awful. And it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. So you're right. So you read the label. You saw sugar-free, and it said number two was high fructose corn syrup. And you said, what is going on? And the answer is, I agree with you. And it's all this labeling stuff, and it's lobbying, and it's terrible. And what's really terrible is you – because you listen to public radio in all seriousness, you are educated because you're reading a label, and what you're doing is you're basing what you're doing based on what you read. You said high fructose corn syrup. Hey, I know that's the same thing. So you can make a decision. What about the person who's not as educated, who wants to lose weight, who then reads the label and just puts it in, doesn't read the back part and says, sugar-free, it's not going to put on weight for me, I can take it. What are we doing to them? We are lying to them. I wanted to just ask you a question, Mac. What sort of a product was it that said no sugar and then you found high fructose corn syrup as the same?
I can think of two right off. One was a Coffee Mate, a liquid non-dairy creamer. And there's also a Cool Whip product, that whipped toffee stuff that also says sugar-free.
Okay, because I'm going to go look at those in the store, and I think what we may do is we may do on part a little on a show, we may do the Dirty Dozen, and we may look at a bunch of them. I'm going to go and do a Dirty Dozen expose of fake in labeling.
Oh, that'd be great.
How do we get the right labels on things? So thank you for bringing that up. Good point.
By the way, I have lost 137 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I've given up sugar.
Oh,
in two and a half years. So it works to read labels.
Excellent.
It works to read labels, and you are doing a great job. Congratulations.
And you said that you do have an ounce of sugar on occasion. That's okay because it helps the medicine go down.
Oh, just a spoonful. No, I don't have that much. But if it's fifth ingredient or lower, I can have it. But if it's got more sugar than that, I pass.
Congratulations.
Yep.
You're
Thank
doing
you.
It. Keep up the good work.
Thanks. Appreciate taking my call.
And before we punch out for the week, Zorba, let's take another quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for another installment of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question comes to us from a listener named Chuck, who is traveling to Mexico. Chuck writes, "Hello, Zorba. First, I have to say that whenever I can, I try to catch your show on our local NPR affiliate. I'm traveling to Mexico next week, and I'm interested in your recommendations. Our destination is the city of Hermosillo in Sonora, Mexico. I figure at a minimum I should have an updated tetanus shot, which is probably a good idea, even if I wasn't traveling."
Well, first of all, the best place that I tell people to look for information on what to do is to go to the CDC website. Mm-hmm. So anyone traveling, go to CDC, that's Centers for Disease Control, .gov, and on the first page you'll see travel. You'll see advice for travelers, which is great. They then show a map of the world. You punch on the country that you have, and auto pop the latest CDC recommendations. Mm-hmm. And I always go to that. I always refer to that. I never refer to my memory. Why? Well, my memory is not always there. And number one, and number two, the recommendations change. So number one, go to that website. Mm-hmm. Number two, being updated with a tetanus shot is good. Make sure you get a DTaP. D, capital T, small a, P. DTaP.
What's
which
that?
Which is a tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. What we're doing now is we're updating people on pertussis or whooping cough vaccine. And we do that when we give a tetanus. And the recommendations now is everyone should get a DTaP because, frankly, a lot of adults are no longer immunized for pertussis or whooping cough. The other name, the Chinese name, by the way, for whooping cough is the 100-day cough, because often you cough for 100 days. It's awful. Mm. So if you're going to get a tetanus shot, get a DTaP, go to that site, look at it. You need to have some Cipro or another drug for traveler's diarrhea, and you may need to have something else from your doctor. But go to the CDC website.
When you said the Chinese name, I thought you were going to say it in Chinese.
You know what? If I could say it in Chinese, I would say it in Chinese.
Consulting Zorba is a lot more enjoyable than a tetanus shot. Well, at least a lot easier. Make sure to check in with Zorba before your next adventure. Just send your traveling questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, if you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Adam Kenny Powers Friedrich is our executive producer, and Brad Stevie Kohlberg is our technical director. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark.
Stevie and Kenny.
With an invitation to you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0225Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.